I once responded in a question for a grant application for this podcast that the people I admired most were great adventurers, great writers, and great journalists, with the kicker naturally being that the best was a combination of all three. And in John Lee Anderson, the very special guest on this episode, we have an exemplar of those three labels. Anyone who listens past 10 minutes will see the great adventurer. Anyone who's looked into the details of how John Lee put together Che's biography will understand the great journalist. But then to top it all off, anyone who's ever read something that John Lee's written will understand the great writer. I'm sure John Lee Anderson didn't quite realize just how mighty of a moment this was for the podcast. I think I managed to hide my nerves behind a facade of professionalism, but John Lee and I ended up spending more than 4 hours together as we inhabited a closed, cold, empty drinkers club on a January London morning, recently. In the 2 hours recorded, we talked about his early life, which involves vagabonding, sleeping wild and moving through Africa as a 13-year-old, John's experiences that led him to first see his name in print for the Lima Times, a behind the scenes for how John put together the Che biography, and then, of course, John's worldview, you know, how he thinks about revolutionaries today, what he sees as a cultural nihilism from the poison of narcos, and then in between the lines of all of that, there is a whole lot more as well. John Lee Anderson is a staff writer from The New Yorker and author of multiple books. Links to more about him will be in the description. And to you, my dear listener, if there's ever been a better reason to leave a review on this podcast, then I don't know of it. Therefore, pump a 5-star review into your Spotify and as well into your Apple. The more reviews this show has, the more authority I can present the podcast with to potential guests. So do it for John Lee, do it for me, and leave me a fiver. Navigate the interview with the timestamps below, and with absolutely no further ado, here is the journalist, author, adventurer, John Lee Anderson. Welcome, John Lee.
Thanks, Ryan.
You were giving me some really interesting history about where we're seated before.
The Frontline Club, yeah. This is... Already, it's only, I think, 20 years old, but it's an historic place here in London. Became very quickly a hub for journalists, publishers, many talks in this very room with very important people. I think I seem to remember that when the Iraq War began and there was a schism within the cabinet of Tony Blair, who, of course, supported the war along with Bush, a group of senior civil servants, if it wasn't cabinet members, came here and announced their disagreement with the war. It was big at the time, here in this room. When Julian Assange launched WikiLeaks, it was here in this room. When, you know, and so on and so on and so on. Many people have come in the room downstairs, which is sort of the bar, restaurant, hangout room. There's a paraphernalia from a lot of the members on the wall. Von Smith, the founder, there's a camera there that has a bullet lodged in it. The camera saved his life. Von started out in the military, but turned to, out of a spirit of adventure, really turned to frontline journalism, which is when I met him and his guys in Afghanistan when the Soviets were pulling out. And over the years, they did the most sort of front line of television coverage around the world and all the conflicts. And in the end, after the 8th member of Frontline had been killed, he decided that was it. And he turned Frontline News into the Frontline Club. And so, yeah, this is the place.
Were you here when Assange announced?
I wasn't. No, I was in some war somewhere.
What was the chatter from your mates here about when he did that?
You know, initially, I think everybody was like, you know, Assange was the kind of glossy new thing, wasn't he, initially? Fairly divided opinion about Assange over the years. I'm not a fan.
Why is that?
Trump.
Okay.
You know, he helped Trump get elected.
Oh, so, right. Because of the Clinton emails.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And, you know, so, yeah. But let's not go down that rabbit hole particularly. It's not foremost on my mind. We just happened to be sitting in the room where he launched it. I had no problem with his, you know, initial decision to make things more public. But I think towards the end of his time out and about, he was working more to protect himself and to do damage to the what he saw as the American system that was out to get him. And by doing so, he basically put himself in the same camp with Vladimir Putin and helped get Donald Trump elected, which has done huge damage to the world. Yeah. So.
Well, to switch away from the Frontline Club, you actually overnight it came out, the memoirish New Yorker piece you'd sent me. And in it, there's a throwaway line, one which I'd heard you hint at in another interview, but I've actually never heard you expand on before. The year is 1970, you're 13 years old, and somehow traveling East Africa alone.
Yeah, well, it wasn't intended as a throwaway line. It's what happened. I grew up all over the world, wasn't very happy about returning to the States where we'd lived briefly when I was 11. We went to Indonesia, had to be evacuated, came back. I ran away a lot. And my parents, as a solution, asked if I wanted to go spend a year with my uncle in Liberia. I had an uncle who was a geologist living in Liberia, and I was happy to do that. And but I was a bit of an animal and wildlife nerd, and so I really wanted to go to East Africa. And I earned money by mowing lawns the summer before I went. And my parents and my uncle and aunt agreed that I could go to East Africa halfway through the year in Liberia. I went to the international school. And there was sort of, between my parents and my relatives, they knew someone in each East African capital, you know, that were supposed to look after me. And I got a charter flight. So I had just turned 14. A couple of weeks after my 14th birthday, I flew to Kampala, but it coincided with Idi Amin's seizure of power. the couple that I was supposed to stay with in Kampala turned out to be the sort of vaguest of connections to my, I forget whether my parents or my aunt and uncle knew them, but they were a pair of sort of curtain twitching middle Americans who didn't like Africa, didn't know where they were. And didn't seem to know much about anything, and I really disliked them. And in those days, I looked older than I was. I probably looked 16, but I would tell people I was 18. And when Africans asked me, I would tell them I was 28. Anyway, after a couple of days, this is of course pre-email, pre-cell phones, pre-almost everything. I told this couple that I was leaving, and that I was going to Queen Elizabeth National Park, which is on the border with the Congo in the west. And they were sort of flummoxed, but let me go, I think. And they didn't know what to do about it. So I just left. And I started traveling around on my own and got on a local bus. And my real plan was to go to the mountains of the moon. I was just going to use Queen Elizabeth was just a stopping a ruse. Yeah, I was going to cross into the Congo and go into the mountains of the moon. Because I'd you know, nourished myself on biographies of adventurers and explorers from the 19th century, and I had no sense that I couldn't do the same thing, nor any fear on that trip. Anyway, lots of things happened. I went on from, I ended up going elephant hunting with a gospel minister whom I met, because I camped out on my own in Queen Elizabeth, next to a pile of poached animal skulls, I remember. Oh, and this white guy showed up with a local guy who was his sort of acolyte, Patrick. And, you know, I wonder what he must have thought. It's like, who is this kid? You know? Anyway, sure enough, they invited me over to eat. I get elicited my story. I was pretty guileless. And they said, well, we're going elephant hunting. Do you want to come along? So I said, okay.
Sure.
So I did. Thankfully, he didn't kill an elephant over the next week, but I saw a lot of Uganda and went into a lot of amazing bush. and went through a few roadblocks with crazy army guys, who were, of course, Amin's marauding soldiers, but I had very little sense of it at the time. Anyway, went on to Kenya, Tanzania, climbed Kilimanjaro, lied about my age to be able to do that. Went to Ethiopia, got into trouble there too. You know, didn't write, didn't call. Nobody knew where I was. And I was sort of eventually hauled back to Liberia, not exactly in disgrace, but with a seriously inflamed foot too, according to the doctors, you know, I came within about a couple of days of getting it amputated.
Holy shit.
Yeah. It was just the first of several near amputations, as it turns out. I would be on a skateboard now if I hadn't been luckier with one limb, I think. But I had a great time. And for me, this was really formative, and I always wanted to return. I didn't want to leave Africa, and I always wanted to return. So, you know, it led me to make several further attempts to get back to Africa soon afterwards.
So you're a pretty wild kid running away from home all the time.
Yeah.
But is it really the case you just walked out the front door one day with a bit of money in your pocket and got on the bus, was wild camping, was traveling with these people? How are you moving throughout the world, you know, as a 13-year-old?
So like I say, I had agreed to stay with these people, and they were American Foreign Service people in Kampala. And I did, you know, they picked me up at the airport. I went to their house, but then I left their house and I went to the square in Kampala where you got buses. And I got on a bus to Kasese or wherever it was. And then in Kenya, I did the same thing. It was a Peace Corps volunteer couple in Nairobi. And I told them I just wanted to go down to Tsavo Park, which is on the border with Tanzania. But really, I was going to go across the border and climb Kilimanjaro. It was on my list, you know, which, you know, you're not supposed to do as a kid for whatever reason. And I did it. And I then, after Kilimanjaro, I wanted to go to the Serengeti. And I got a bus as far as you can go. I went to Olduvai Gorge and then to the Serengeti, and they left me. And I didn't have a tent. I had a bedroll. And I'll never forget, I had no money, right? So I ate whatever local people ate. And again, when they would see me, the Africans, they would say, "What are you doing here, boy?" You know, and I would say, "Well, I'm 28, you know, I'm just doing this." And yeah. Nobody ever tried to stop me. Mostly people tried to help me. And the Serengeti one was kind of funny because I slept near a kind of rock mountain one night. And for me, this was Eden. And I'll never forget, going to sleep with the sound of the rock hyraxes, these little like marmots, you know, that inhabit those rocks, and waking up seeing elands and zebras in the near distance. And the next morning, I was happy and on my own, entirely on my own, and walking along this dirt road. I wanted to go to Lake Tanganyika. It was, you know, a couple of hundred miles away. And it was a dirt track, really, through the bush. And I don't know how long I'd been walking when a Land Rover appeared, you know, cloud of smoke. Inside were these five or six, as it turned out, British scientists. And again, you know, they saw me, obviously stopped and said, "What the hell is this kid doing here on his own?" And I told them, and they said, "Well, where did you sleep last night? What are you doing here?" You know, I said, "Oh, over there, you see that rock?" And they were saying, "Oh my God, you know, we're studying a pride of lions. We were about 200 meters away from you." Yeah. And they were heading to some bush airstrip and putting their lead scientist on a bush plane to go to Nairobi. And initially they said, "Well, you want to ride?" And I said, "Sure." You know, so I got in the car. And in the course of the car, Land Rover, in the course of the time rattling along, they convinced me to go with the scientists on this free airplane ride to Nairobi. So I was easily distracted, you know. Just as I had set out for Mountains of the Moon and a guy invited me to go elephant hunting, I went with him. I was easily diverted from my plan to go to Lake Tanganyika by foot because I had a free airplane ride to Nairobi. And anyway, it was like that. I didn't have any fear. And I had a huge thirst for adventure, you know, and tried to live it wherever I could and whenever I could. And that was really all I wanted to do from the time I was pretty young. So when I said earlier that I ran away, I did, but it wasn't because I was angry with my family or wanting to cause them any anguish. I was a bit feckless. I didn't think about it.
Right.
The time I ran away in, when we arrived back from Indonesia in California, was I was heading into the mountains. I wanted to go live off the mountains in the wild, like, you know, men I'd read about. And the police managed to catch me just as I was heading into the Sierras in one of the national parks. And then later in Washington, I ran away again. But that time it was to go live inside the Smithsonian Natural History Museum. Because before we'd gone to Indonesia, I'd worked there as a volunteer, and I knew the place. And I thought that would be really cool to live, you know,
absolutely
behind the exhibits and all that. And anyway,
did you pull off any nights in the museum?
No, because I convinced a friend, Andy, to go with me. And on the way there, we were hitchhiking to Washington. He said, "Let's stop and see my grandpa. He's really cool. He'll be fine with it." And I remember his grandpa very well. We stopped in and saw his grandpa, whose name was Poppy. And we were 13. Poppy gave us whiskey and cigars. And we were sitting there puffing these cigars and getting sick and drinking whiskey, which I'd never had before, when our fathers burst through the door.
Nice.
He turned us in. So we never made it. No, no. We were both hauled back home.
Have you ever been able to recreate the pure rawness of that adventure, 13 in Africa?
In retelling it, as I am with you, I've alluded to it in a couple of pieces, aspects of that year, because it's relevant. For instance, I returned to Liberia years later, so I've used some of my memories in the pieces I've written about Liberia from the earlier time. I had a means of comparison of what happened to Liberia between, you know, 1970 and 71 and after the wars began there when I returned. So, but yeah, I have a very vivid memory of what it was like then, at least the Africa that I saw. So, you know, I haven't written it in book form, but I've, you know, I remember it very, very well.
But I mean to say, the purity of that adventure, where there's no, you like you say, feckless. One person says, "Come with me." Sure, I'll go with you. No care in mind about the destination, no thought about can I even do this, etc. That pure rawness, because obviously you have a 1,000-page book full of adventures, but the pure rawness of that early one, has any other time in your life you been able to recreate it?
Oh, I see what you mean. To live that as purely as I did then.
Because that's just pure adventure.
Yeah.
There's no end goal in mind.
I would say, I mean, and probably until I became a journalist and I began, you know, began reporting also with a spirit of adventure, but now, you know, for a purpose, you know, I continued to have, to mount my own expeditions to, you know, I went on to Alaska, then I was in the Amazon, and I continued to do things like this until I was, well into my 20s. So, yeah, but that one was maybe the ultimate one because it was the first one where I was truly on my own in a continent that I was discovering for the first time, that I'd always dreamed about and read about. And it was the sort of the best time ever. Yeah, you
as
know?
A prepubescent.
Yeah. It was fantastic. And when I see pictures of myself then, I mean, I didn't even have peach fuzz, you know, on my chin. I was, and the idea that I told people that I was 28 is just unbelievable that anybody actually thought it was true. Anyway, but yeah, it was a different time, and I was lucky, you know, I was lucky, maybe because I took people aback and the world, you know, it's easy to say the world was a different place then. Yes, it was. It's always a different place 20, 30, 40 years on from what it was before. And I suppose bad things could have befallen me, but, you know, they didn't.
Yeah.
By and large, the people I met were good people who, you know, probably kept their own counsel but took me in hand and tried to keep me out of trouble, I guess. Mm. I realize now. When I see pictures of myself, when I realize how young I was.
Right.
And I lived in a world in which there was no GPS, you know. My parents couldn't track me. There was no email. If you wrote aerograms and took them down to the central post office, and if you were lucky, they would arrive in their destination 2 weeks, 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
You know. Nobody called anyone because it was so expensive. And if you had, you know, if you had a phone, in a lot of the world, there were no landlines. And so there weren't mobile phones either. So if you wanted to make a phone call home, you would have to also go down to the central telephone office in the capital of the country and book a call at what for me was always huge expense. And so you'd book 3 minutes for some prohibitive amount of money to talk to your parents or something a week hence. Or it would be a collect call, you know, which meant that they paid for it. I did a few of those, but not on this trip. It never even occurred to me to call them. Yeah.
All those details, no GPS, no one knows where you are. Such a young boy, land you don't know. Like, these are all elements of risk.
Yeah.
Do you think that risk is a necessary input to it actually being an adventure?
That's a good question. I suppose so. I mean, I've never really been drawn to the kind of extreme sports that, you know, we associate nowadays with that. You know, bat wing gliding off of cliffs or,
stuff.
You know.
Yeah.
Surfing the monster waves or, you know, scratching the bellies of bull sharks or, you know, this kind of stuff. I just think I can understand why people do it, but it feels a little absurd to me. It's all about sensation. You do that for sensation. I love sensation as much as the rest, as much as the next person, but I've never felt the need to do it in that way. I have done some mountain climbing. I've done whitewater rafting. You know, I've done those things. But, and I think part of the thrill of the sensation obviously comes from an element of risk. But it's also about going fast. I suppose if the human body goes fast on anything, it's risky. Driving fast, water skiing, you know, any of these things. Skydiving, cliff climbing. You know, at one time or another, I've tried a lot of those things, but really it was more, for me, it was more about exploration, I think. I wanted to experience what I'd read that the first explorers experienced.
Yeah.
You know, that was really what it was about for me. It was the discovery of the original world. So for me, the risk was never really something I gave much thought to. It was more about trying to experience what they had experienced. I could think of no higher ideal for me than that. For me, this was the ultimate experience, to see the world as the first men had seen it. So if it entailed risk, that was part of it, but it wasn't the main reason. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like some of these risk-taking adventures that people do today for the sake of the risk. No. And so when people have said later, because I went on to war, and lots of wars, people who don't know war usually ask, invariably ask, oh, so you're an adrenaline junkie, or you get off on the adrenaline. And I have resisted that as well, because I think that's rather similar to what we're talking about, you know, tightrope walking between skyscrapers or something. It's like, no, I don't think I go to war to get shot at. No, it comes with the territory. But I wanted to see war because it's something men do that I think is abhorrent, and yet it's been an engine for history. And I want to see that firsthand. I think when I was very young, probably there was an element with some of these experiences of wanting to achieve manhood by proving myself to myself, like confronting fear and danger. So in that sense, yeah, a little bit of the element of risk, but it was, again, always a kind of abstract thing.
I completely project onto that notion you gave about the ultimate ideal would be to sort of discover some part of the world for the first time. You know, that explorer's ambition to truly stumble across something new and original and untouched, etc. What's the closest to that you've ever gotten?
Oh, it's happened a few times. When I was in Africa as a boy, apart from the East Africa trip I took several trips, what we called upcountry, into the bush in Liberia, which was very untouched at the time. Apart from one road which went to the middle of the country, there were just a network of trails throughout the entire country. And in those days, you could effectively walk, not without danger, through the jungle on these network of trails, probably into the other countries too. And I remember going along one trail. I went with my uncle's cook, who came from an upcountry village. It took 8 hours to walk to from the nearest road by foot. And I stayed in this village. And from that village, we went. There were still elephants in Liberia at the time, and I wanted to see them if I could. There were very few. And we went on an old hunting trail that was so old that nobody had been on it for years. You had to crawl because it was, you know, you macheted the vines hanging down.
Yeah.
And in this one section, you had to crawl. Nobody had been in it in who knows how many years. And we were crawling alongside the palisade of the bush devil's sanctuary. The bush devil is a figure who lived in the jungle. Each tribe had their bush devil who would periodically abduct the children when they came of age in the village and take them away to the bush school, which was this place where they would be taught the facts of life, jungle lore, get scarified and so on, and usually be returned with life to the village. Sometimes they never return. Gross. And I really wanted to go to the bush school myself, but obviously nobody would let me go. But we were crawling alongside it this time. And I was in the village when the bush devil came and took three kids from the next hamlet. But on that same hike, we came out of it, we came through that bit and then into more open jungle, and then after some hours reached a clearing, a very primitive clearing. When I say primitive, it was a few trees had been felled, you know, by axe. And there was a woman there with a child. She was cooking a lizard. And this child was maybe four or five. The minute the child saw me, it burst into screaming terror and did not stop screaming the entire time we were there. He had never seen an outsider before. It was four. It's happened to me with older people too. in the Amazon in when I was around 20, going up a river near the Brazilian border, tributary of the Ucayali in Peru. And we came across, I was in a canoe with a motor and a native guide, just me and him, and we could see in the distance two women with long black hair in a pirogue, you know, in a dugout, and they began screaming and waving paddles, and quickly got to the riverbank and ran. And when we arrived there, the little, it was a very, you know, these were indigenous people, very living very poorly, how should we say, originally. Can one still say primitively? You know, and it was gone. It was deserted. These were, I realized later, isolated people, people you would say are uncontacted today. That happened to me a few times, but we didn't have really terms for them in those days.
Right.
The Amazon, you know, you went up rivers and there were people who had never seen white people before. Or in this case, they were terrified and they kept screaming a word over and over again, which it took me some time to figure out what it was. But I could hear the word pishtaco. And I later found out that pishtaco was a term that was used by these indigenous people to refer to outsiders, a kind of monster figure who comes to steal the oil from your bodies.
Okay.
That's why they were so scared. And according to an anthropologist I met a couple of years later, his belief was that this had its origins in the colonial era when the Spanish conquistadors first came into the jungle and may have killed and boiled natives for the grease in their bodies so as to grease their muskets. And that this had sort of remained as a kind of terrifying myth and folklore throughout the Amazon. And whenever certain groups felt threatened by incursions, the outside world coming in, this sort of mythology was revived as a means of defense. Indeed, 2 years later, they killed people on that river. They went from being frightened when I went up to being aggressive and hostile 2 years later. So it's possible. I could go on, but I mean, you know, yeah, I do remember. I have seen glimpses of the original world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned the word luck a number of times. Through circumstances, you were lucky to, for it not to have gone a worse way, etc. Luck, by another word, is serendipity. As you look back on your life, your career especially, what is the role that serendipity has played in your life?
I mean, I you know, I, I'm not sure. I think there's a lot of determinism in everything we do. I think I've had, you know, I've had bad things happen to me. I haven't always been lucky. I have been unlucky too. But I've been lucky in the sense that, you know, unlike some friends of mine, I haven't been, I've been abducted, but I haven't been abducted and killed. I have been shot at, but not shot. I have been, you know, I've been in car crashes that haven't been fatal. So, and so on and so on. I've nearly drowned, but not drowned in the sea, you know? So is that luck? I'm not sure. Is it? Yeah, maybe it is luck or serendipity. But in each case, I used my wits or previous experience to save myself. So, you know, luck, yeah. But I don't know how to put a percentage on it.
Think about forks in the road, one in a million chances. Had you not gotten on the tube that time, that morning, you would have missed this opportunity. Moments of serendipity that drew in a certain direction.
I had a few. There was a period. I remember, actually, I do remember now that you bring that up like that. There was about a 6-month stretch in the 80s in Central America where basically three times I was on a plane or a chopper that either went down right afterwards, shot down, or crashed. Wow. Yeah, repeatedly.
Yeah.
It happened three times in a row. And that, I guess that was luck or destiny.
Exactly.
Yeah. And those felt like close calls at the time.
Yeah.
But I remember remarking on it at the time and thinking, maybe I shouldn't get on helicopters, or maybe I shouldn't. But, you know, that kind of superstition stuff, I carry it for a little while and then it goes away again. Yeah. I'm not really that superstitious.
Are you religious?
No.
Do you subscribe to the notion that we're just bags of meat and bones?
No.
And once we're done, it's done? Or is there another element?
I don't know. I think that I would like to think that, you know, our spirit counts for something. You know, that this idea, this notional spirit that we carry counts for something additional to the bag of meat and bones. I don't think we're only that. But I also don't think that it's, it doesn't seem very sophisticated to go through life and think, when I die, I'm going to go and like bask with the angels on some cloud somewhere. It doesn't feel very realistic to me. We go through life adhering, most of us or many of us, to this idea of reason and the factual base, the scientific world. Mm. Well, there's no scientific basis for the idea of heaven or God. So I don't personally believe in it. However, I've been around the world enough and with enough different types of people to realize that that idea of hope, really, or call it faith, is important for people, for many people. It gets them through life. It gets them through difficult times. So I've gone from being sort of probably pretty intolerant about that, especially with the more orthodox religions, to more tolerant of it over time. And I have met people who are people of faith, nuns, priests, who are really good people, wonderful people, who because of that faith, have decided to give their lives to others. And that's an extraordinary thing to witness and to be near.
Right.
I respect that. I especially respect that it tends to be amongst faith-based people, not exclusively, but this idea of living amongst the poor or in some horrible remote place and risking one's life, giving up the comforts one has born with to help out in some even small way, people who are less fortunate, I think is extraordinary and worthy of my respect. So if what's led them to do that is some kind of faith in a supernatural, fine. You know, I don't particularly go there, but I respect it.
Yep.
When it's obvious that they are good. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think that having a faith is the only way to be good, but I have seen that it's a way for people to structure themselves and their lives within a frame of goodness, and it's this is an old-fashioned term I know, that I can recognize. I do recognize good and evil.
Right.
You know, I do adhere to those notions. I have met good people and I have met evil people.
Yeah.
I don't, whether or not it's politically correct to use that terminology, I have no doubt that that's the case.
Good and evil.
Yeah.
I think that hasn't quite yet made its way into unpolitically correct speech.
I think evil is something that people don't go around talking, using the term, because
really?
They think, yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't. I think it's been
like
expunged.
It's just a relativism.
I think it's expunged. Yeah. I mean, God Almighty, you know, look at the op-eds about that try to explain why this or that despot or torturer right. or serial killer is the way they are. Mm. It's like, I'm sorry, but you know, at a certain point, you are what you do. So that's yeah. evil. If you've committed evil, you're evil. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have to be a, you know, a Baptist to say that. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah. You don't have to morally explain away everything. It's okay no. to just say that is across the line, therefore.
Hmm.
I'm in a pickle, John Lee, because, you know, there's so many directions I'd like to take it, but I have to triage the time for questions.
Sure.
An anecdote from your life, which I really think is incredible, is the first time you actually see your byline. It's at the Lima Times. You stroll in off the street. They put you in a conference room and say, just write up a couple memoirish experiences and these can be your first publications.
I had I was in Peru trying to figure out how to stay on there because I was doing these sort of self-initiated trips to the Amazon and wanted to do more.
And how old are you at the time?
I'm 22, I guess. And I saw the Lima Times was this little weekly newspaper that had been going since the 1860s. It was nice. Kind of, it was begun by British expats and, you know, there it was over 100 years later, still going. And I saw an ad in it saying, we need reporters or reporters needed. So I thought, I can write, you know,
yeah.
not really. But my mother was a children's book author. I had always, she had always encouraged me to write. I had a little newspaper when I was 10 in Taiwan. It didn't last very long. And I'd written a few things. So I thought, well, I'll, and I'd always aspired to write. So I walked in and I told the editor that received me that I was answering the ad. And I think I said something like, I can write. Mm. And he said, well, sit down, tell me about yourself. And I think probably in the same way as those scientists in the Serengeti, they probably saw this callow kid who was, you know, completely guileless. And you know, I was burbling probably about my Amazonian trips. And he said, well, why don't you, you know, he... yeah, go sit in our conference at the big table, nice room, and just write up your experiences. And I did, and they started publishing them. And it was a huge thrill because, yeah, as you said, it's an extraordinary validation to see your name in print.
Right.
And I think what they did was they just started reeling me in, you know, at that point and sort of trying to teach me the carpentry, the tricks of the trade of reporting, and gradually gave me more, you know, gradually gave me some reporting assignments. So that was sort of, yeah, that was the beginning. I've run across some of those pieces lately. I have four of them. I later did other pieces for them, but these four jungle chronicles, really. And it's interesting because I had no real knowledge of craft at that point, but I had a sense of story. And, after 40 years later, I see that, I mean, the writing could be improved, but the consciousness is there.
Right.
The awareness is there. The perception is the same. And I think it's the same perception I've always had of the world.
You really recognize that person.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly, you know, I still remember the first time I looked out of a sandbox, I must have been about a year and a half old, and saw the world. I remember the moment.
Mm.
It's one of my, I think it's my earliest memory.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's something.
Yeah, it is. And I'm quite sure it's real. It's not one of those told memories.
Yeah.
Because it's just a very primary, you used the word pure before, I guess pure moment where I looked beyond the sandbox and I saw the world and I was suddenly aware that there was a world out there. And you can see this in little kids at the moment at which they're kind of having a kind of a growing spurt and they suddenly are more aware, they have a bigger radius around themselves. And I think it was that moment it's not a memory with dialogue or anything much, but it's the moment at which I perceive the world. And I'm pretty sure I look through the world with those same eyes today, just with more experience. That's all. Yeah.
You said it's self-initiated trips into the Amazon. Hmm. What does that mean?
I mean, I just... I went to the Amazon. You know, I just took myself to the Amazon. Yeah. I went on my own. It wasn't for... This is before anybody was talking about ecotourism and these things. Mm. I wanted to see the original world. Mm. So I pitched up in places like, a river settlement that you had road access, like a place like Pucallpa on the Ucayali. It's the Amazonian headwaters. I asked around if there was a guy with a peke peke. These are these long wooden canoes with a long shafted propeller motor. So you can go up very shallow rivers. They call them peke pekes because that's the sound they make. I bought a shotgun, you know, that kind of thing. Mm. And I would say, let's go up that river. I would ask around, like, where is the, you know, the most remote place we can go. That's the kind of thing I did.
Did you ever read Lost City of Z, David Gran?
Yes, I did later, yeah. In fact...
How much did you love that book?
Oh, great. I mean, David's such a talented writer. What a wonderful writer. He's amazing success he's had. So, you know, more power to him. We've only met once because, of course, I live abroad. I don't know where he lives. But New York. Like that at the New Yorker. Yeah.
Yeah.
About 4 years ago, I was in the Brazilian Amazon, actually Mato Grosso, one of the reserves of the Chavante indigenous people. And they pointed to some mountains in the distance, and they said, that's where Fawcett went down.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah. I was actually in the area where the whole thing went down, yeah.
So you were on El Dorado's doorstep.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That was cool. Hmm.
Forgive me if this is too sappy of a question, but have you, because at this point you're 22, you've got these self-initiated trips into the Amazon, you've documented this African story, you lived in Taiwan, Indonesia, like we're barely scratching at the surface here. Have you reflected on just how unusual your upbringing was and how it's informed you as you grew older?
Yes. I mean, I'm aware that it's different to other people's, but it's the life I've lived. So when I was young, I was very aware of it. And sometimes it was a bit of a problem because I grew up in 9 different countries. I went to, 12, 13, 14 different schools. And I was always the new guy. Yeah. And so in a new place, sometimes a new culture, a new language. And especially when you're an adolescent, you know, people get pretty judgmental. And I had this kind of big life and wasn't easily cosseted or regimented, you know. And so there were times I realized that my big life, especially if I was telling people about it, caused issues, you know, people would be... It would make them feel competitive. They wouldn't. They would not believe it.
Right.
So there was a period of time in which I just didn't. I probably didn't talk about my past or my life very much, you know, in order to fit in. But I am who I am. I mean, I always have been. So, but yeah, maybe a little bit larger than life. As a kid, you know, as a youngster growing up, so yeah, very aware. But my family was also different than other families. We had, you know, we were a multiracial family. I had sisters of, you know, other races who my parents adopted, and we were, that was fairly unusual for the time. No. Yeah, so I have a Chinese sister, a Costa Rican sister. My eldest sister's my genetic sister, but born in Haiti. And we, you know, there we were in Asia and Latin America and all over the place. So I, yeah, I guess we were unencumbered by feelings of racialism in my family, uniquely maybe as a white American family. I say that with, you know, sincerely. My parents were like, if they were one thing, they were deeply anti-racist. And that was my earliest kind of political acculturation, I think. And we lived it. And I was always very aware that we were different. But I took that to be my life. And I liked it.
And you've got a son? Do you have other children as well?
I have two daughters and a son.
How did you instill adventure into them?
I think, you know, it just comes with the territory. They were all born here in England. We moved to Cuba when the eldest was 4 and the youngest was 3 months. Mm. We lived there for 3 years. And then we moved to Andalusia, Spain, where we lived another 6 years. So the first 10 years of their lives, mostly, we were in Spanish-speaking cultures. I took them also to... that time I began reporting... for the New Yorker and going to war. So I didn't take them to those places, Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on. But I did take them, you know, on safari to Africa, to Morocco. I've taken them on trips with me, either singly or as a family, to, you know, Brazil, to the Amazon, to Peru, to Mexico. And different places in Europe. So my kids all have, and to places in the States where we have relatives, that kind of thing. So they all have their own sense of adventure. I tried to be a little more...
Like a cool dad?
I tried to be a cool dad, but I also tried to be careful not to let them know how early I had gone off and done things. Because I'm aware that, you know, kids try to emulate their parents sometimes. That didn't necessarily stop them, but one of the things that I should say is that going back to my year in Liberia with my uncle Warren and Aunt Doris, when I was about, I don't know what age, I found out my mother was, it was her and her brother, Warren, the one who became the geologist. And while we lived all over the world, Warren lived in Death Valley and Hawaii and spent a lot of time in Alaska and then moved to Liberia. And I idolized Warren because he was kind of a mountain man. Yeah. And he was deeply, you know, if you saw a picture of him, it looks like Ansel Adams or something, you know, John Muir. He's like, you know, looks like he was carved out of, wood. And I found out from my mother that when he was about 14, they'd lived on a ranch. And he had his own trap line and hunted. And when he was 14, they let him live in the mountains by himself for the whole winter.
Wow.
So once I found out that Warren had done that, that became something I could do, you see. So I then pushed the envelope. And remembering this, I tried to keep that kind of knowledge about my age from my son when he was sort of near the same age. Yeah.
He just takes off to Liberia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So... it's there, you know, if...
Nice. First of all, regarding Che, do you think it's the case that it's the work you'll be most remembered for?
Makes me feel like my life is already over when you ask like that. I suppose it's... So far, it's the book that... that most people, you know, it had the biggest audience and it translated in a lot of languages. And I was associated with the finding of the body. So, I guess so. Although Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really that aware of my public persona, but you know, some people know me for the stuff I do for the New Yorker, but maybe internationally people know me best as this, the you know, for the Che Guevara thing. Yeah.
But the details for how the book got made, I find so romantic in one sense, you know, like you were living on the by the skin of your teeth financially.
Yeah.
It took so long to write, such a huge risk in undertaking this project, but it obviously paid off in spades. Could you just take us through the inception of the realization that there could be, there was a gap in the market for a good Che biography, all the way to you, say, befriending his widow, spending all this time with Alberto, and et cetera?
Yeah. So it really begins in the end of the 80s. I had left reporting in Central America to do first one and then another book with my brother, Scott. We co-wrote two books, journalistic books. The second one was a book about conflicts around the world. He then went off to write a novel. And I felt myself to be a kind of student of violence, political violence at that point, and managed to sell a book idea to a publisher about guerrillas. And I spent 4 years going around the world living with different guerrilla groups and writing a book about the kind of culture of insurgency, a narrative culture, a book on insurgency. And it was in the course of that, doing that, that I kept bumping into the figure of Che Guevara. And this is sort of end of the 80s, so the Cold War is ending, not quite over. My book comes out in 92, so it's ending as I'm writing it. And I'm aware that I have, because I've been steeped so long in this world of, you know, whether it was the Burmese Karen or the Sahrawis in the Western Sahara, the Salvadorans, the Afghans, the Palestinian Gazans, everywhere I went, people talked about Che Guevara. And so Che died when I was 10. Therefore, I wasn't like a university student with his poster on my wall, but I was aware of him. And then I began to think, yeah, what do I know about Che? Whatever happened to him anyway, you know? And I looked into the books written about him. Most were long since in remainders piles. The posters were no longer on the walls, but he seemed this incredible figure that told the story of what had been the Cold War confrontation between East and West. And it was also a very attractive figure in a lot of ways. And I came up with this idea that I should write the book of his life that had never really been written. Those that had been written were hagiographies or demonizations, and they were from 30 years before. And so I came up, you know, I did a treatment, a proposal, and sold it to my to a publisher, and promised I would do this book within 3 years. or 2 years, I think. And it became a 5-year project. But so the world was changing as I did this. This was 1992. You know, this was literally a year after the Soviet Union collapsed. Cuba was hanging on there. I then realized I had to go to Cuba to try to convince the Cubans and Che's widow, if I could, to give me access. The only calling card I had was this book about guerrillas, which wasn't particularly, it wasn't a judgmental book. It's a book about why people take up arms to fight for an ideal. And Che seemed to me the personification of that. So I made one trip to Cuba and was approved by the Politburo to go, you know, after making an approach to the Cuban embassy. But I was kept at bay from the whole Guevara crowd, and I couldn't even see the widow. I felt like I was being kept at arm's length. And I returned again, and this time prevailed, managed to see Che's widow. And she was a very forbidding woman who just listened to me stolidly as I kind of made my pitch. My elevator pitch was about 30 minutes long. involved lots of sweating. And at the end of it, she didn't say anything, I remember. And I said, so will you support me? Will you help? And she kind of grunted, yeah. And I thought, at that very instant, I realized I couldn't come and go from Cuba and get anywhere, that I had to move there. And I said, if I move here with my family, what about if I move here with my family? She said, yeah, that's a good idea. So I did. I waited for my wife, was very heavily pregnant at that time with our third child, our son Maximo. Waited until he was 2 months old. I came ahead and set up a place, and we started living in Cuba at the same time as it began to implode. Cuba was a few months away from having its own social kind of implosion, and what then became the rafters crisis, and a lot of our neighbors fled on rafts and so on. We were living in Cuba. It was a very difficult time to live in Cuba, but we had a kind of an amazing experience. My relationship with Che's widow was such that I would go over to the house she had lived in with Che. It was pretty much kept the same. She allowed me to go and sit at Che's desk. It still had a uniform of his hanging next to it. It had the books he was reading when he went off on the desk. Everything was moldy, and I would read at his desk his books. And then on the days she felt like it, we would sit there and chat downstairs together. And on the days when she wasn't in a good mood, that was it. I would just go away and come back. And this went on for a long time. And gradually, she began to take a liking of me or trust me. And, you know, we were going through all kinds of hassles in Cuba because of the situation. You know, there were no electricity, no water. We had little kids that would be sick. She periodically would help. There were people who also sort of inserted themselves into our lives, and she would periodically warn me about them because they were coming from, let's put it this way, a certain agency of the Cuban state. Yeah. And I began to realize how the whole place operated after a while, that she was her own entity because she was Che's widow, but herself had been somewhat marginalized. And I think she took a risk with me, but decided, and she waxed and waned a bit. But eventually she said, you know, you should, and she would tell me people I should go see. Meanwhile, I was seeing whoever I could anyway, but it's a difficult society at that time, you know. This is only 30 years after, 25 years after Che had died, and these are people who still feel themselves to be part of a revolution that is just hanging on by the skin of its teeth. And most of what they had done with Che was secret. It was the stuff of, you know, of state secrets. It wasn't journalism. It wasn't history yet. And so I had to kind of really drag it out of people. At a certain point, I began to feel that after about a year and a half, I felt like I was getting no closer to Che because I was living in the place where he had been turned into this kind of godhead figure.
Right.
And that I needed to go to his origins. So I began to plan a trip to Argentina where he'd been born. Mm. And she had introduced me to Alberto Granado, the young, little bit older than Che, doctor whom he'd had his famous motorcycle journey with and who later had come and emigrated to Cuba. And he was a jovial old guy. And I invited him to, he agreed to come along with me to Argentina. So he did, and we spent in the summer of 1994. He was, I think, 74 then.
Nice.
You know, he was almost a half century older than me. Just a funny guy, you know. Still a little bit guarded. He didn't entirely trust me, I don't think, in the beginning, because he had adopted the whole Cuban thing of, like, you know, I'm a socialist, Americans are Yankee, imperialist, whatever. Even though I was there, I was kind of on sufferance. But once we were in Argentina for a while, this was, after all, his original culture, and we began to meet Che's siblings, those that were still alive, Roberto, Celia, the brothers, sisters, a friends that he'd hung out with, that they'd both hung out with when they were teenagers and chased girls with and gone on motorbike rides with and all that stuff, he began to relive his youth, and everybody did. And it became, I was just one more of the lads.
That's amazing.
And it was great. We went all over Argentina together. We traveled with other friends who had hung out with the young Guevara. And eventually, their protective sort of, cordon sanitaire around the things they would tell about Che began to fall away. And I began to learn a lot about the young Guevara. And this was key for my understanding of the figure. You know, I learned that he was, for instance, he was completely fearless, took all kinds of crazy risks, had a huge spirit of adventure. He chased indiscriminately girls and women to a kind of unusual degree, considering that he was a really handsome guy. And this was something they all remembered about him but had never said in public before. Turned out to be true, all of it. Anyway, it was fun. And so he became just a very believable figure to me. I really connected with the young Guevara in many, many ways. In some ways, kind of a kindred spirit. And so that helped me begin to understand him better. When I returned to Cuba with Alberto, it wasn't long before Aleida, Che's widow, gave me a copy of his unpublished diary for the 3-year period after the Motorcycle Diaries. And it just really opened my eyes about who he was. Because, like me, he was a youngster who always kept a diary. And, you know, everything he did, he wrote down. And there was everything. It made him a very believable figure. You know, there he is doing dumb stuff, chasing girls, deciding what he's going to be in his life, being a bit of a dilettante. And that, together with some of his letters home, back and forth to his aunt or his mother, a picture began to emerge of, and that with the kind of reminiscences of his friends, a picture began to emerge of a flesh and blood guy whom I really understood. And then I also got the diary, again unpublished, of his time in the Sierra once he joined Fidel and they were in the mountains. And there, this was arguably more important than the previous diary. You know, there he describes killing his first man, executing a traitor, all of which had been kept secret by the revolution for 30 years. But it helped me understand how he was trying to gird himself into becoming this hardened guerrilla, and, you know, how he really is, you know, he later talked about socialism and the new man, the new socialist man. He was the new socialist man. He created himself and then tried to inculcate the same sort of conviction and sense of self-sacrifice in others, which intersects with the Christian or the Christ-like ideal that everyone carries around with them, especially in that kind of revolutionary firmament. And it is obviously one of the reasons why he began to inhabit a kind of otherworldly space once he died. And I think, you know, I feel that I really got under his skin. I really understood him. And so, yeah, you know, I took quite long trips from Cuba to track down people that, you know, to Bolivia and others. People that had never talked to Moscow as well. People that had never talked in 30 years opened up. And I found out a lot about these episodes of his life that were never written about before. So, and I was able to fill in most, maybe not all, but most of the blanks in his life. And
how surreal did it feel to have this subject that you've identified is a character worth writing about, and there isn't a great biography for him, to then get access to the widow, to Alberto, to these unpublished diaries, to be hanging out with his childhood friends. Did it feel surreal at the time? Oh my goodness, I actually have this access, like a pressure. I must write a good book.
Yeah. You know, yes, I don't know how anxious I felt or not. It was just my life, you know. I had no choice. I was embarked on this. I had followed my own counsel for a long time, you know. I left the kind of careerist path of reporting in Central America to go off and write a book with my brother, then another one about guerrillas at a time when most of the people, reporters that were my age, were trying to get jobs within the news organizations. You know what I mean? I was just following my own counsel. These were things I had to do, you know, in the same way as a 13-year-old going to Africa. I think, you know, when I think back on it now, well, who in their right mind has a family at the same time as they go off to, you know, different guerrilla wars over 4 years? But that's what I did. I had to do that. That was me. That was what I had to do. And once the Che project began, I had no choice but to succeed, you know?
Yeah. Were they tough conversations with the missus, or was she always incredibly supportive?
She was. She was incredibly supportive. She never questioned it. She was real.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, she's, you know, she's the kind of woman whom I could have, 100 years earlier, could have said, we're going to go to, you know, the frontier in Alaska or live amongst the Apaches, you know, and she would have gone. She has that same good spirit of adventure, very hardy, you know, uncomplaining. Best of times, worst of times, or worst of times, best of times, you know. She remembers with fondness the fact that we lived out of a bucket of, you know, we had to bathe in buckets and had no electricity in Cuba, but really admired the way the Cubans were getting on with their lives. It felt, you know, like a very authentic time. Yeah. Yeah, I'm lucky. She's never once pressured me not to do what I do.
My reading of Che is that the character is consistent throughout, but there is distinctly two different worldviews of the Motorcycle Diaries Che and then the Revolutionary Che. How deeply did you identify with the Motorcycle Diaries Che?
Oh, a lot. I mean, you know, he's still a feckless youth, you know, to overuse a word I've used before here. He could have gone in any direction. You know, he's thinking about going to Paris. He's thinking about girls. He's writing poetry. He's getting angry about politics. He's not formed yet. It's gradually, and later on in the next journey, you know, he and Alberto traveled the length of South America as far as Venezuela, and then Che returns to take his medical exams. Alberto is older and has already got his doctoring certificate. So he stays in Venezuela to work at a leper colony, and Che is supposed to go get his exams, get his doctor certificate, and join him. And that's what Che does. He goes back to Buenos Aires, takes his medical exams, and then takes off with another friend, Calica Ferrer, whom I also hung out with and got to know really well, and travels again via a different route the length of South America with the aim of going back to Venezuela and joining Alberto. But along the way, Che begins to meet, he's not called Che then, he's called just Ernesto Guevara, but they go to Bolivia, which has just had a kind of revolution, a reformist revolution. There, they start hearing about the socialist revolution that's taking place in Guatemala. And he, along the way, he's becoming more political. And at the last minute in Ecuador, he decides not to go to Venezuela, but to go to Guatemala. And he goes to Guatemala. And this is one of the crucial moments in his life. In Guatemala, he finds himself swept up in this sort of hothouse of this atmosphere of excitement as young sort of wannabe revolutionaries, young socialists, communists from all over the world, mostly around the region, have flooded into Guatemala, to excited about the fact that this government has seized the land of the United Fruit Company and is handing it out to the Indians. There's all kinds of youngsters wanting this to be a, you know, the new Bolshevik revolution, whatever. And he gets swept up in that. And he watches it. He's there when it's overthrown by a CIA-backed paramilitary army. You know, goes for protection into the Argentinian embassy, meets all kinds of revolutionaries there who also are seeking protection because they're going to be picked off and executed if they're out on the streets. Eventually is amnestied, makes his way to Mexico, where, you know, this is already a sanctuary for Spanish Republican exiles from the 1930s. So he's part of this anti-fascist swirl. He meets followers of a guy called Fidel Castro, who's also, you know, now doing time for an uprising he's launched in Cuba, soon to be amnestied, soon to meet Che in Mexico City, and the rest is history kind of thing. It was a unique moment. Yeah. And it's a moment in which, because of what he witnessed in Guatemala, he became more dogmatic. You know, he became convinced that Marxism was the way to go. Until that point, he'd been quite open-minded. He was on the left, but reading everything.
But one gets the sense, although he was a leftist, that he could have just as easily sort of become a free market capitalist had he had a different. Just my reading of it was he was so open, had such a curious worldview.
Yeah.
And obviously the people he met drew him in one direction. But do you think that's the case? He could have, maybe not just as easily, but there is a worldview, there is a timeline where he went the other way.
Yeah, there's a moment in which he adopts a dogma and seeks and ceases to search. I remember, and it happens in Guatemala and Mexico, and I remember reading him doing that in his diary and in his letters and saying, no, come on, keep your mind open. Don't close off now. Don't close off now. In myself, I was thinking. But he did. He became very doctrinaire for a while. It helped forge him into the person he became as a revolutionary. But, you know, from then until his death, which was only, say, from the overthrow of Arbenz in 54, when he radicalizes, until his death in 67, it's only 13 years. His time in Cuba was only about 6 years. By the end of his life in Bolivia, he was fighting, you know, he was fighting for what he believed to be the right way forward. But I have a strong sense that he was less doctrinaire and less radical. By then, he had seen the failures in certain aspects of the left, particularly in the Soviet Union. He had fallen out with the more doctrinaire communists about this. He was a man of, you know, real intellect. And yes, he went through his doctrinaire phase, but he was, I believe, less doctrinaire towards the end.
Yeah.
He was only 39 when he died. You know, he was still a young man. So
he packed a lot of life into those years.
He sure did, yeah.
Is there a part of him, for being so fundamental in a revolution, that you are kind of jealous of?
Jealous of?
Wish you could have had something so powerful to have happened in your own life. Not to say it couldn't still happen, but I just think, morality aside, right or wrong aside, he lived an exceptional life.
Yeah.
And it would have been something to have been with your brothers on the mountain overthrowing a country.
Yeah.
Again, morality aside, but
Yeah. No, I don't know about jealous of it, but it's a path I could have taken myself. Yeah. And almost did in my teens, late teens. If I had followed my nose, I would have ended up fighting on behalf of Robert Mugabe in
what?
Yeah.
What's this about?
And then later the Sandinistas, neither of which turned out well. But I went through a period of about 3 years from 17 to 20 where I was very tempted to go and fight on behalf first of the black liberation movement in then Rhodesia against the white minority Ian Smith regime. And then afterwards, I became very enamored of not so much the Sandinistas as the idea of killing Somoza in Nicaragua. I was never a pacifist and could have easily gone that way. Things turned out differently. So, I mean, I could and still can relate to the young Guevara's decision to take up arms and fight, the sense of injustice and all of that. And would have made the same mistakes as so many other revolutionaries, which is not really thinking about the day after. It's like, okay, so what do we do now? You know, actually not envious. I've been around enough revolutionaries not to feel envious or jealous of them. Maybe in a kind of, if I were to stand back and say, oh, I wish I could be as innocent as them to feel that kind of pure hope as they seem to now. But I now have seen so much horror come from it in some cases that I'm not envious of any wholehearted conviction when it comes with a gun anymore. These things have a way of burning hot and then burning themselves out, usually in a miasma of gore. But the exception, I think, was the kind of the Cuban Revolution-inspired guerrilla wars of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, in the sense that they were on the spectrum of light to dark that you can have in these. If you have Pol Pot and what the Khmer Rouge did at one end of like apocalyptic totality, you know, really apocalyptic utopianism on the one end, and then the Cuban Revolution on the other, it was pretty light by comparison. Che executed people. Most of the people, I don't know of anybody that he executed that didn't deserve to be executed. That's controversial to say. Mm. But if you've got somebody in your ranks who's raping and murdering people, you don't have a jail to put them in. What are you going to do? Mm. So, you know, what did it all come to? I don't know that you can evaluate or measure it's, or if it's justified to measure revolutionary experiences on what they become eventually. It means you could evaluate all societies based on what they are now compared to what they believe their origins were. If the United States independence war against Britain was a noble thing, what should we think about it now that it's produced as its maximum expression of Donald Trump? You know what I mean? So who's going to throw the first stone here? I don't think that the Cubans or Che was necessarily wrong in fighting the way they did when they did. Did they know that they were going to unleash horrific counter-terror? I don't know that they did. And it's what happened at that time. The world was changing radically in the wake of World War II, decolonization. The America was just stumbling around as a superpower. You know, it's what it was. Che existed at the time he did. I don't know that a Che-like figure could reappear today, because people don't want to fight or die for ideals. They want to fight and die for Lamborghinis.
Yeah, this is a thread I've seen you pull before. There's no more revolutionaries. There's just narcos.
I mean, it's a pretty blanket statement, but it's true.
Mm. What do you mean by that?
I think that the collapse of the left and the leftist ideal with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the triumph of the capitalist economy that globalized our economies 30 years ago, if you look at Latin America, you'll see that to all intents and purposes, the idea of idealistic revolution, mostly from the left, I guess, has disappeared, and it's been replaced by many violent actors, but they're all fighting for drug gangs, cartels. With the triumph of the American market, the narco economy has expanded and swamped the entire region. 60 years ago, there was no narco economy. When Che was around, there was a few jazz players smoking dope. That was it. Now you have, Brazil is like the second largest consumer market for cocaine in the world.
Wow.
It wasn't, not even 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So you now have a narco economy that has replaced, that has not just not replaced, it's added itself into the as a new layer to the economic reality in the Americas. So in other words, if you're poor in Sinaloa or wherever, Chaco, or you know, anywhere in Latin America, you can potentially become rich by getting into that. And those didn't exist before. If you were poor, you were going to be poor, unless you were lucky and somehow got out. But now, you know, so the possibility of this sort of perverse, cartoonish, gruesome version of the American dream is now possible everywhere. And that's largely thanks to our consumer...
the demand for the drugs.
Our consumer boom of drugs in the United States.
That's a point I had on a guy called Diamant Salihu, who is a really prominent journalist in Sweden, writing mostly about the gang violence in Sweden. Mm. But he is the only person I've seen, now the second, make this point that obviously the supply is a problem, but the demand for it creates the supply, and there's no emphasis given to that.
No.
And so you could not purchase a more blood-soaked supply chain than a line of cocaine.
Exactly.
But it's Friday night in London.
Yeah.
Kilos will be consumed tonight.
Yeah.
And it will just be without a second thought to the death that comes along the way.
Yeah.
You wouldn't purchase something in any other circumstance had you known it was so bad.
No, I agree. Absolutely. That's right. And guess what?
You got to write about this in the New Yorker.
I have a bit, but the death rate, you know, in Latin America, it's the part of the world, the highest homicide rates in the world are in Latin America. Sometimes South Africa, cities in South Africa creep in. Why is that? You remember how I said that sometimes I go back to places where I was at when they were at war, and I wonder why I feel like they're worse today. I think that's why. The death rate in some of these places is almost as high as it was during the time they were at war, if not higher in some cases. And it's all related to the narco trade, most of which came, you know, and where do the guns come from that the people get killed with? It's from the United States. Thank you very much for having a free market in guns, too. I mean, look what it's done to the United States. How is it possible that we have school massacre after school massacre, and there is no legislation to stop the buying and selling of automatic weapons? AR-15s are M-16s for commercial use. That's all they are. They're a weapon of war. It's sickening, and it's obvious that the society is sick if it allows this to continue. And those same weapons that are killing kids in schools across America are being bought and traded, just as the cocaine and fentanyl comes across the desert in Mexico or in submersibles or however that gets to the States, the guns go in the other direction. The guns that the cartels are going around killing people with in Ecuador and Mexico and Venezuela and everywhere else are coming from the United States.
And then the plumbing of offshore finance allows it all to scale to the heights that it does.
Yeah. 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 this is capitalism on speed.
Yeah, completely let loose from the bond.
Yeah,
totally unregulated.
Yeah, yeah, it is, and so that's the big difference with, you know, this is the biggest change I've seen in my life in the region, you know. So what's worse, a world in which, you know, people are fighting for an ideal, maybe it's a wrong-headed one, but they have their ideals in their mind, they're struggling for a better world, people are dying, yes, or one in which they're just killing to get a bigger gold chain.
It's quite a cynical worldview, though.
I don't know. Is it cynical or is it realistic?
Is it realistic?
That's what's happening. Look at Ecuador today. You know, I mean, 3 days ago, the country's biggest drug capo was allowed to escape from the country's prison, and the new president has declared an internal war, shoot to kill, basically, against the 20,000 members of the country's drug gangs who control the most of the export of cocaine to Europe from the Ecuadorian coast. Killed a presidential candidate recently. They invaded a live TV studio and took, you know, all of this is happening in Ecuador today. The drug gangs they're tied in with the Mexicans and the people who buy it in Europe and the United States. It's not cynical, it's reality. I was in Haiti a few months ago, and I spent some time with the drug gangs there too. They live and die in the utmost squalor and kill without compunction. They control 85% of the capital city. In their massacres, of which there were at least 10, I believe, just in the capital last year, more than 100 die in each of these massacres. They gang rape the women, they kill the men. And if they can't take over a neighborhood, they burn everybody alive in it. They all do the same thing. So what does that say about that society? They get guns directly from the United States in container ships because they control two of the country's six ports. What's the international community doing about it? Paying some Kenyan police to go there and restore order? Really? That's the best we can do as an international community?
Haiti's quite close to you, right? Mm. You've been there multiple times throughout your career.
Yeah. I kind of feel strongly about Haiti because I feel like here's a country with just a few million people. You know, it's just across the straits from Cuba. It's very close to the United States. The United States, along with France, kept it in penury throughout the 19th century because they had committed the grievous error of kicking out the slavers. The United States was still a slaving country. So they went along with the French, who exacted huge tribute from the young independent republic for nearly a century. Keeping them in both isolated and, as I say, in penury. They never really had a chance, right? And I feel like this country, which is so uniquely saddled by the burden of history, unfair history, it doesn't make for a virtuous society, particularly. I'm not saying that victims are all little innocent lambs of God. No, they're not. But this is a uniquely poor country. It's much worse than most countries in Africa. In some ways, it is an African country because it's made up of former slaves. Very poor, very uneducated. If we can't sort out Haiti as an international community, I don't think we can sort out anything.
Right.
That's my point, really.
The point being because it's relatively small.
It's small.
Has ingredients for what could be a thriving society.
Well, 50 years ago it was. When my parents were there, it was seen as the future breadbasket right. of the Caribbean. That's yeah. how quickly it's dropped off the grid.
Yeah.
Now it's entirely ecologically destroyed and all devastated. Almost no rivers are left. The rivers that are in Port-au-Prince are filled with garbage. It's all the way out into the bay. There's nothing there. Yeah. It's a slum, one big slum. And now the capital is controlled by the gangs. So, you know, I feel like, yeah, it's difficult, but why do we talk about fixing places that are further away when we have a chance to fix this place, which is just right there?
You're talking from the American perspective.
Yeah. And the Europeans, too. The French have a unique responsibility there that they have evaded. But, yeah, the Americans alone. Come on. This is a place with, you know, I forget how many Haitians there are. Not many. Anyway, so I feel pretty strongly about it.
Yeah. All right. We're running short. So one more on Che and yeah. then a couple rapid fire if we can get sure. through them. Very binary question. Just what do you admire most about Che and what do you admire least?
I admire Che's willingness to put his life on the line for his ideals. I think those ideals were noble in their origin, indignation over social injustice. He is an archetypal warrior in a sense, you know, willing to fight and die for, on behalf of others. This is something that we, most societies admire. We have some figure in the past, maybe a mythological figure who is a Che. Che responds to those sort of noble ideals of sacrifice on behalf of others. That's admirable. Less admirable, what I do not admire about Che, or didn't admire about Che, is the fact that he adopted a very doctrinaire worldview during a key period of time and ceased to look at the possibilities of the others. You know, he narrowed his vision exclusively to the Marxist ideal at the expense of the others. And I think that was an error. I think that was an error of judgment on his part. He had the intellect and the breadth of knowledge to keep his options open and to be more willing to hear other points of view. In fact, he sort of did, but never got to practice it. He began to see the failures of, the Soviet system and began to talk about that. But at that point, he was off fighting again and then died. So, he was uncompromising. I'm not sure that that was always something I disagreed with. I guess my biggest disappointment in him was his adoption of that doctrinaire Marxist credo.
There's that scene when he is in Moscow and he's dining with the elites of this communist society and he's just disgusted at their he's disgusted at their attention to the type of crockery you would be using at the table, that you would be having the nice wine, the nice food, while the rest of the country had nothing. Like, that is admirable. He was, morality aside, whether it was the right idea or not, he lived it.
He lived it.
And
he practiced what he preached. Yeah. He was very uncompromising with himself and with the people around him. I feel bad on behalf of the people who were closest to him, his wife, his children, because he tried to, and ultimately on himself, you know, who leaves a young family to go off and kill and die? He did. It's tough. What he was very tough, maybe too tough, for those human relationships that counted on him as their model, father figure, husband. None of the people who were very close to him were ever quite the same again afterwards. They suffered terribly for his convictions. Right. But, you know,
maybe that's all baked into the cost.
It's all baked in, exactly. That's a good way of putting it. It's baked into the cost of being who he tried to become. He was uncompromising, and he was honest. I guess his honesty is probably the thing that I admire the most. Because that's what you're pointing out, too, about that conversation in Moscow. When he for a while, he couldn't see any ill from the Soviets. But when he finally began to see them close up, he became very critical.
Of power.
Yeah, and he called the spade a spade.
Mm. So how did he then get along with the way Castro turned out?
Well, what do you mean? Because Castro went on for 50 years after Che died.
I suppose, and I'm coming from a pretty deep valley of ignorance here, but was Fidel not an abuser of his power and consumed all the nice things while the rest of the country not necessarily had it?
No, I don't think that's accurate, no. I mean, there's people that say that, but no, not at all. Fidel was very austere. He was very austere and, in fact, unstintingly austere with his own kids, unlike his brother Raul.
Interesting.
He didn't give his kids a very fair break, in fact. He did not treat his own kids. They were not like, they were not given special privileges. Yes, they went to a kind of the special school for the revolutionary elite and so on. They were, after all, the children of the leader. But he wasn't like basking in luxury ever, Fidel.
They didn't have a penthouse apartment in Madrid.
No. No. Fidel was, you could say he abused his power in other ways by being Fidel, by being this, sometimes humorless, very strict, sometimes cruel leader, insisting upon keeping his people in a system that he had imposed. I would say you could argue with that, but the idea that he was somehow corrupt, no, he was not corrupt.
Imelda is the widow, right? Imelda?
No, Aleida of
Aleida.
Che. Aleida.
Okay. How grateful was Aleida when you had discovered the resting place of Che?
Cubans don't express gratitude. What can I say? I think it was traumatic to be reminded of everything, but ultimately to get the body back was very important.
What we cannot know, of course, but what would he make of being such a popular and extremely divisive, but well-known figure 50 years after his death?
I think aspects of it would have unnerved him and made him very uncomfortable, especially the kind of consumer, the Che t-shirt thing.
Yeah, if we didn't have that perfectly heroic image, would he even be such a well-known figure?
I don't know that the two things are distinct. I think the way he died is what made him a heroic figure. He was well known, but he wasn't on posters before then. He became a poster child and ultimately a t-shirt figure and so on because of the way he died, because of the way he confronted death. And he died in the age of celebrity, just as we in the television age, it's the age when the televisual image began to determine the way we related to stars and the kind of star system we devised. And so, in a way, he was part of that. That he's part of that early firmament, along with Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley. And you know what I mean? He was like the hippie with a gun. And so whether he wanted to or not, it's just that's what happened. But there would be plenty of that consumerist adulation that he would be really uncomfortable with. Would he try to use it, as so many people do nowadays, to be an influencer?
Chase Instagram.
God almighty, you know, I would hope not, but who knows, right? Might have his own Twitter account, yeah, an Instagram account.
And he's going to holidays in Bali and getting it all comped by the hotel.
Exactly.
Sebastião Salgado, have you ever spent time with him?
I haven't, no. I know his work, of course. A great admirer of his, you know, his vision, but I've never met him.
Yeah. With your reach and influence at The New Yorker, could you not organize a profile of him? Or is that much harder to do than it seems from the outside?
Possibly, yeah, I possibly could, yeah. I would have to convince myself that that's something that's should be done. I'm not saying I haven't. I don't think that it isn't. And then convince them that it's something we should do, and that also that he would cooperate with. So it's the usual kind of triple, you know.
Nice.
Triple hoops to leap over.
What doors have you found open to you because of the New Yorker title that otherwise wouldn't have been, if it's possible to know?
You know, I mean, there's plenty of places in the world where even government officials don't really know what the New Yorker is.
Oh, really?
Sure. I mean, there's a small elite in each country, like the former ambassador who was in Washington or consul general or person who went to NYU or Harvard who discovered the New Yorker and continues to subscribe 50 years later, 20 years later, 10 years later. There are those people that it helps you with. But there are most other people don't have a clue. They say, oh, you mean New York Times? You know, don't know, right? Mostly for what I do, it hasn't particularly helped. It helps with a certain, you know, educated elite in places like Europe and the United States, but that's where I've done the least amount of my work.
Sure. When I spoke to you on the phone and asked you if you'd spent time with Christopher Hitchens, you said you both loved him and hated him.
Yeah. So when my Che book came out, he interviewed me by phone.
Oh, nice.
For about 2 hours. And I knew who he was, and he wrote an essay about it. And it was a laudatory review, but also, you know, brilliant in its own right for his own philosophy, you know, for his own thoughts put on paper. And that's since been republished and so on. That review is in anthologies and so on.
I think actually it's in And Yet, and it's called Enough About All That or something.
Maybe.
I don't remember. Like the closing of the Che book, I think, was the...
Huh, maybe. But yeah, I remember it was, you know, it was an impressive piece of work. And then, so that was probably 1997 or 8. And I don't think we ever met, but I was aware of him. And then the Iraq War came along, and I was in Iraq reporting on the ground, and in the summer of 2003, becoming aware that insurgency was starting against the Americans who had just invaded. And I wrote a piece about that, using the term insurgent to describe the insurgents, right?
Oh, okay.
Whereupon
I missed the
Christopher Hitchens.
Okay, go on.
Someone sent it to me. He was writing for Slate at the time. He wrote a piece slamming me for using the term insurgent to describe the insurgents. And then immediately he said the kind of the Neville Chamberlains on the left. So furious. He basically just used the fact he picked up. It could have been anybody writing it, but he picked up on a recent piece I had done in which I described what I knew to be the beginning of an Islamist insurgency, nationalist and Islamist insurgency in Iraq, you know, which was, as you know, an invasion and an occupation that he supported. right? I didn't have a position. I was merely talking about what was happening. But he used that to then immediately go on it and use the term he described as a term that was being, that legitimated the terrorists who were fighting against this, you know, noble project. And just like Neville Chamberlain, I can't recall exactly his wording, but it was like the Neville Chamberlains of this world, the nervous Nellies who would sell us, you know, I can't recall. He used my piece to sort of have a go at the kind of left. Mm. And it was completely wrongheaded.
No acknowledgement to your previous interview?
No, none whatsoever. I was so furious. And I talked with I said, what should I do? And she said, just, it's Christopher. It doesn't matter. He does it to everybody. Leave it. Which I did. And, took me a while to get over my anger, but I was busy reporting in Iraq, and it went away.
Right.
He went on being the champion of the war he was, and about 2 or 3 years later, I was on a trip to the States, and a friend of mine who knew him well said, do you want to have lunch with Christopher? I told him you were here, and he said, yeah, great. So we had lunch, and there was no acknowledgement of the fact that he'd attacked me.
You didn't bring it up?
No, I didn't either. He had just come from, we met in Palo Alto at his wife's parents' house, this kind of rather palatial place, where they spent the summers. And he had just come from a funeral in Portland or Seattle of a young soldier who had joined the U.S. Army because of him, because of his writings. And he had gone to the funeral. He'd also quit smoking, which pissed me off because I was still smoking. Then I was really pleased to be with someone in California whom I could just smoke with. And it turned out he'd quit smoking, but still drank at lunch. I didn't. I'm not a grudge holder. He was wrong about that, but it wasn't the end of the world. And my editor was right. She said, just forget it. You know, you'll get into a pissing match and it's, what will you get out of it? He just hoovered up that term. It could have been anybody else, but it was me.
How do you think about the next generation of your comrades, journalists, and the media landscape they are inheriting?
It's a toughie. The media landscape is, you know, radically transforming as we speak. I mean, we're sitting here doing a podcast, which, of course, was something that didn't exist 10 years ago. Which is great, and it's captivated. It's as a genre, it's captivated a lot of younger people. In the end, it doesn't matter what method you use or platform. I hate the term, but you know what I mean. Whether it's written or audio or the medium, if the function is the same, we can see that the people still like and cherish and respect storytelling, that it's key to who we are as people, right? And we need it, and we need to have storytelling accompany us with integrity wherever we are, so that we know ourselves, I think. Even if newspapers go the way of the dodo or now mostly digital or whatever, I'm less concerned about that than I am about the polarizing landscape in which people are less capable of being truth tellers in their time, maybe, and finding themselves only informing niche audiences or not finding any niche at all because the economic support system has collapsed or a new viable one hasn't been fully reinvented. I worry about the monopolization of media by big tech billionaires, not all of whom are nice people. I'm thinking of Musk or salubrious, people who are having I don't think they're healthy. In some cases, they're just philanthropists, and that's fine, and that's great. I don't particularly like Bezos, but he hasn't been bad for the Washington Post, as far as I can see. Murdoch, I feel, is a pernicious and villainous influence on the media landscape and has been for 30 years. It's worrisome to see what's been happening to the media landscape. But, you know, in a way, maybe it's always been thus, you know? Lord, whatever his name of the Daily Mail was a big advocate of Hitler back in the 1930s. And, really? Yeah. One of the biggest. So that's what I mean. We have to be aware of what's going on. We have to always strive to find new ways to be independently voiced and above all to keep our relevance. We can't permit people like Donald Trump say from places like the White House that we are the enemy of the people. He is the enemy of the people. And I would like to see this period hopefully pass with journalists and not people like Donald Trump more empowered, or else we're going to have to become more activist on our own behalf. We cannot allow people like that to manipulate the minds of people and to then view us as falsifiers, as, you know, charlatans or whatever they think of us. It's problematic. So I do worry on behalf of the new generation, but I'm pretty confident, again, going back to the fact that here we are doing a podcast, which didn't exist 10 years ago, that new forms of expression will continually come up and we'll find ways to communicate the truth to one another, or what we believe to be the truth, in a sincere, you know, in a sincere effort that some people, you know, going into the future. Yeah. You know, as for the economy of it, well, you know, I spent most of my career not really thinking about where the next meal was coming from, and it worked out in the end. So, you know, I'm not too worried about that. You know, people in the middle of the bush in Africa will start writing on a typewriter somewhere to do a little pamphlet that becomes a newspaper, or, you know, use a microphone to make their own podcast or radio station somewhere. You know, this is just part of our impulse. So we're going through a bad patch at the moment, I would say. I haven't talked about AI. And, you know, I think it's still too early to really know where that's going to go. It's just the latest sort of wrench that's been thrown into the fire. You know, maybe it's a really biggie. But I don't know yet. For the time being, I'm not going to worry too much about it.
I want to push the audience towards the episode with Brian Klass, who at the end, I think, gives such a great, compelling state of affairs of this. And I'll send it to you after if you're interested. It's just a 5-10 minute soundbite. He himself is such an overachiever. Professor of political science, big Substack, big podcast, and big best-selling author. So done so well in so many mediums, but is one of the best at this, at navigating this changing media landscape, and the way he thinks about it is really compelling. But we've reached the end of our time, John Lee. So two rapid ones. Are you working on an autobiography?
I just wrote a memoir piece for The New Yorker, and people are asking me to write more. So I may. I haven't started one yet.
Okay.
But at the moment, I've been happy with just writing sort of pieces of it. So we'll see.
Not to be too morbid, but with something like this, you can never do it too early.
No, exactly. I always thought I'll have to wait till I get old. But maybe I should start doing it now. I don't know. I'd be happy to write some kind of memoir, whether of my whole life or just the sort of coming of age period, which lasted quite a long time.
Right.
So we'll see. I might make that decision soon.
Are you mates with Bill Finnegan?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
You guys talk a lot?
Not a lot. I mean, he lives in New York. I live here. But we exchange emails, and I see him whenever I'm in New York. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. Yeah.
And his memoir, autobiography,
yes,
is just so compelling front to back.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And he did very well with it. You know, everybody's got their own book to write. well, let's see. I have to be convinced that it's the right thing for me to do next, and that there has to be a publisher who wants me to write that book. So we'll see.
I'm sure that'll sort itself out. Are you really a one project at a time guy?
I wish. No, I've always got several pieces I'm writing at the same time. I closed that piece last week on my Canary Islands thing. I'm writing a piece about the Amazon now for the magazine. I have 7 books I'm reading. You know, I mean, nice. You know, there's always a documentary series I'm advising on. There's always, but really, yeah, I am kind of a one project. I'm pretty monothematic. If I'm writing a piece, I have to be doing that to the exclusion of all else. I can do twiddly bits on the side, but nothing, you know, all embracing.
Final one, John Lee, and this is a question every guest has gotten. What is a country you're particularly bullish on?
Happy about?
Bullish to say you think it's got a really bright future ahead of it.
Gosh. My silence says a lot, doesn't it?
It's kind of concerning how often silence has been greeted this response recently.
I'll bet.
Mexico?
No, not particularly.
Australia?
Not particularly.
France?
No. Look, I mean, it depends on, you know, I can find something good to say about almost any country,
right?
Even somewhat bullish, small b. But I'm not an oracle. And given the fact that we have a kind of implosion of the democratic model taking place, the rise of populism, amidst undeniable climate change, I can't be bullish about a place like Australia, France. I mean, I used to point out Uruguay as the country in Latin America which worked the best by comparison with the others, because rule of law seemed to pertain there, and that's kind of true. It's one of the exceptions. In that way, it's more like a Western social democracy from Europe. But in the last, and it's still probably the most successful model, political model at the moment, but it's begun to have its own problems with violence, and the narco thing has begun to move in. Chile, it really has, just in the past year. So, which was the other country I would have pointed to. So I would have 3 years ago expressed a certain bullishness about them.
Yeah.
I'm less likely to now. Again, it's not about cynicism. It's about a kind of realism. I think we're in a uniquely uncertain limbo at the moment. I can't call it anywhere anymore, I don't think. I would like to be able to. I think there are great forces at work. I'm hopeful about young people being caring about the environment now. But I would love to see them do more than just do clicks on their phones and actually get out and do something about stuff. When I start seeing that on a bigger scale, I'll be maybe more hopeful. So at the moment, it's a bear market, not a bull market, I would say.
Let's end it on that, John Lee.
Okay.
Thank you so much, mate.
Thank you, Ryan.
Absolute pleasure.
Pleasure to meet you.